UOP Multimedia presents The Ominous Continuity with Kevin Cole, creating insights on the history of Western civilization, international relations, education theory, technology, and current events. This is Episode 5, H.G. Wells and the Roundtable, The Idea of a League of Nations. Hello, my name is Kevin Cole, and welcome back to Episode 5 of the Ominous Continuity Podcast, produced by UnityOfThePolis.com. In the last episode, I introduced another chapter I authored entitled Identity and Distinction, William Torrey Harris, Mass Schooling, and the Open Secret of the Universe. We took an in-depth look into the rationale and the educational foundations of the Rhodes Scholarship through the lens of its introduction into the United States post-1902 by the first Commissioner of Education, William Torrey Harris. Episode 4 also provided background into Harris's own hands-on role in the establishment of the educational hierarchies that exist today, his favored curricular meritocracy, and the view of the automata in civilized society. We also covered the immense importance of his St. Louis Philosophical Society in the promotion of speculative philosophy, the introduction of Hegel into English, and last but not least, the open secret of the universe, its meaning, and the role of language and culture in polity formation, which ties it all together. With Episode 5, we're going to be exploring the rationale given for the League of Nations in 1919 by H.G. Wells and key members of the Rhodes-Milner Roundtable in their text, The Idea of a League of Nations. This is to be a crash course into the first-hand discussion surrounding the need for world government in 1919, in the varied ways they sought out to achieve it. This text was prepared by H.G. Wells, Lionel Curtis, Viscount Grey, Alfred Zimmern, Gilbert Murray, Lord James Bryce, all who have been previously identified as key players in the Rhodes-Milner supranational organization. In an effort to garner support for my research and publications, I'll be releasing the first half of this influential text for free. If you'd like access to this and many other audiobooks, you can download the entire audiobook recording and many others of this nature by becoming a subscriber to my Patreon page at patreon.com/KevinColeUOP. To download the Idea of a League of Nations audiobook as a one-time contribution, please visit unityofthepolis.com. In other news, I was recently interviewed by Nick Ulbrich of the Tangent General podcast, and we had a lively discussion about the current state of affairs, the unknown history of the Trivium Method and Dorothy Sayers, social cybernetics, and the state of opposition movements, and much more. I'll be sure to make that available to listeners when the audio becomes available to me. Special thanks to everyone for tuning in and your ongoing encouragement and support. If you appreciate my research and analysis and would like to help fund my book and future projects of UOP Multimedia, you can support my work directly at unityofthepolis.com or at patreon.com/KevinColeUOP. You can also do so by picking up a copy or subscription to my UOP Research Brain, which is a historical database and mind map containing over 11,000 individual entries and 27,000 links, which I've been compiling since 2009. If you have any questions, interview requests, topic suggestions, or anything at all, please feel free to contact me directly. With that in mind, this is The Ominous Continuity. Thanks for listening. The small group of British publicists who have collaborated in presenting the idea of a League of Nations have long been working towards universal peace from an angle of their own. Under the chairmanship of Mr. H.G. Wells, they have formed the League of Free Nations Association and have divided among themselves the principal problems connected with the formation of such a league, subject for extended study, appraisal, and suggestions for solution. The remarkable qualifications of this group assure to their treatise a high place in the literature of world peace. The Idea of a League of Nations, H.G. Wells, in collaboration with Viscount Grey, Lionel Curtis, William Archer, H. Wickham Steed, Alfred Zimmern, J.A. Spender, Viscount Bryce, and Gilbert Murray, The Atlantic Monthly Press, Boston. Copyright 1919 by the Atlantic Monthly Company, the Atlantic Monthly Press, Incorporated. The idea of a League of Nations. 1. Unification of human affairs to an extent at least of a cessation of war and a worldwide rule of international law is no new idea. It can be traced through many centuries of history. It is found as an acceptable commonplace in a fragment, De Republica, of Cicero. It has indeed appeared in and passed out of the foreground of thought, and reappeared there, again and again. Hitherto, however, if only on account of the limitations of geographical knowledge, the project has rarely been truly worldwide, though in some instances it has comprehended practically all the known world. Almost always there has been an excluded fringe of barbarians and races esteemed as less than men. The Roman Empire realized the idea in a limited sphere, in a mechanical and despotic fashion. It was inherent in the propaganda of Islam, excluding the unbeliever. It was the dream of the medieval church, a dream which, partly in harmony, partly in rivalry, with the medieval empire, it was constantly trying to realize, however ineffectually. But here again the line was drawn against the infidel. It may be said that the political unity of Christendom, overriding states and nations, was the orthodox and typical doctrine of the Middle Ages. The individual states were regarded as being, in the nature of things, members of one great body politic, presided over by the Pope or the Emperor or both. It was the idea of a world supremacy of the empire which inspired Dante's De Monarchia, but as Lord Bryce has remarked, Dante's book was an epilogue instead of a prophecy. The Council of Constance, 1414-1418, brought together the Christian princes of all countries, the higher dignitaries of the Church, the ambassadors of many cities, and the most celebrated scholars of the age, with the Pope and the Emperor at their head. It was, however, the last assemblage of the whole Western Christendom. It cannot be claimed that history shows any continuously progressive movement of human affairs from a dispersed to a unified condition. Rather, it tells a story of the oscillating action of the separatist and unifying forces, and the process of civilization itself, if we use the word in its narrower and older sense of the elaboration of citizenship in a political and social organization, and exclude mechanical and scientific progress from it, has, on the whole, been rather on the side of fragmentation. It was, for example, much easier for loosely organized tribes and village communities, scattered over wide areas, to coalesce into vague and often very extensive nations, like the Scythians or the Thracians, to cooperate in infictiones or federations, like the small peoples of central Greece, than for a highly developed city-states or fully organized monarchies, possessing a distinctive culture and religion, and definite frontiers, to sink these things in any larger union. For such higher forms of political organization, enlargement occurred mainly through conquest, which created unstable empire systems of subject and subordinate peoples, under the sway, which might, of course, be the assimilative sway, of a dominant nation, rather than real unifications. The Renaissance presents a phase in history in which a large vague unification, Christendom, is seen to be breaking up, simultaneously with the appearance of a higher grade of national organization. Machiavelli, says Termulin, may be conventionally taken as the typical exponent of the new mental forces which ultimately turned Europe toward the conception of more or less absolute princes, with highly organized standing armies, see his Art of War, national religions and educational autonomy. Machiavelli, with his aspiration toward a united Italy, involving a disintegration of the empire, opened that phase of the national state in Europe, which reached its fullest development in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. Before the Renaissance, Europe was far more a unity than it was at the close of the reign of Queen Victoria, when it consisted mainly of a group of nations, with their national edges sharpened and hardened almost to a maximum, each aspiring to empire, and each acutely suspicious of and hostile to its neighbors. The idea of internal organization for peace seemed far more utopian to the normal European intelligence in 1900 than it would have 800 years before. But while these political and social developments which constitute civilization in the narrower sense of the word were tending to make human societies, as they become more elaborately organized, more heterogeneous and mutually unsympathetic, they were also coming into play throughout the 18th and 19th century for the first time, upon a quite unprecedented scale, another series of forces diametrically opposed to human separation. They worked, however, mutely, because the world of thought was unprepared for them. Unprecedented advances in technical and scientific knowledge were occurring, and human cooperation in the reaction of man upon man, not only in material but also in mental things, was being made enormously more effective than it had ever been before. But the phases of international relationship were not altering to correspond. Phases usually follow after rather than anticipate reality, and so it was that, at the outbreak of the Great War in August of 1914, Europe and the world awoke out of a dream of intensified nationality to a new system of realities entirely antagonistic to the continuance of national separation. It is necessary to state very plainly the nature of these new forces. Upon them rests the whole case for the League of Nations as it were presented. It is a new case. It is argued here that these forces give us power and novel in history, and bring mankind face to face with the dangers such it has never confronted before. It is maintained that, on the one hand, they render possible such a reasoned coordination of human affairs as has never hitherto been conceivable, and that, on the other, they so enlarge and intensify the scope and evil of war, of international hostility, as to give what was formerly a generous aspiration more and more of an aspect of imperative necessity. Under the lurid illumination of the World War, the idea of world unification has passed rapidly from the sphere of literary idealist into that of the methodical, practical man, and the task of examination of its problems and possibilities, upon the scale which the near probability of an actual experiment demands, is thrust upon the world. All political and social institutions, all matters of human relationship, are dependent upon the means by which mind may react upon mind and life upon life, that is to say, upon the intensity, rapidity, and reach of mental and physical communication. In the history of mankind, the great phases seem to be marked by the appearance of some new invention, which facilitates trade or intercourse and may regard it as the operating cause of the new phase. The inventions of writing and the wheel and the road and the ship, of money, of printing and letters of exchange and joint stock undertakings and limited liability mark distinct steps in the enlargement of human intercourse and cooperation from its original limitation within the verbal and traditional range of the family or tribe. A large part of the expansion of the Roman Empire, apart from its overseas development, may be considered, for example, as a process of road-making and bridge-building, even if its trans-Mediterranean development was a matter of road-making combined with shipbuilding. The Roman Empire, like the Chinese, expanded on land to an extremity determined by the new method of road communication, and sought to wall itself in at the last of the limits of its range and the centers of its strength. The new chapter of the human story, again which began with the entry of America and the oceanic lands upon the stage of history, was the direct outcome in the bold sailing out upon the oceans with the mariner's compass and the suppression of the galley by the development of sails and rigging rendered possible. The art of printing from movable types released new powers of suggestion, documentation, and criticism, which shattered old religious organizations of Christendom, made the systematic investigations and records of modern science possible, and created the vast newspaper-reading democracies of today. The whole of history could indeed be written as a drama of human nature reacting to invention. And we live today in a time of accelerative inventiveness and innovation when a decade modifies the material of intercommunication and range, swiftness and intensity alike, far more extensively than any century before. Within the present century since 1900, there have been far more extensive changes in the things that occurred in the 10 centuries before Christ. The automobile has raised the limit of possible road travel from 10 or 12 to 40 miles an hour. Wireless telegraphy and the aeroplane have abolished such things as inaccessible regions. And instead of regarding Around the World in 80 Days, first published in 1872, as an amazing feat of hurry, we can now regard a flight about the globe in 15 or 16 days as a reasonable and moderate performance. The teaching of history compels us to recognize in these new facilities factors which will necessarily work out in equally revolutionary social and political consequences. It is the most obvious wisdom to set ourselves to anticipate as far as we can, so as to mitigate and control the inevitable collisions and repercussions of mankind that are coming upon us. Even if we were to suppose that this rush of novel, accelerating contrivances would be presently checked, and there is little justification for any such supposition, it would still behoove us to work out the influence which the things already achieved will have upon our kind. And it is not simply an increase of range and swiftness that we have to consider here, though these are the aspects that leap immediately to the eye. There has also been, for example, a very great increase in the possible vividness of mental impact, in education and the agencies of journalism and propaganda, and there has been an increase of power at present incalculable, owing to vast strides in the printing of pictures and to the cinematograph and the gramophone and similar means of intense worldwide information and suggestion. 2. While all these things, on the one hand, point plainly now to such possibilities of human unification and world unanimity as no one could have dreamed of 100 years ago, there's been on the other hand a change, an intensification of destructive processes of war, which opens up a black alternative to the specific settlement of human affairs. The case, as it has been commonly stated in the propaganda literature for the League of Nations, is a choice between, on the one hand, a general agreement on the part of mankind to organize a permanent peace, and on the other, a progressive development of the preparation for war and the means of conducting war which must ultimately eat up human freedom and all human effort, and as the phrase goes, destroy civilization. We shall find as we proceed that these simple oppositions do not by any means state all the possibilities of the case, but for a moment or so, it will be convenient to confine our attention to the enhancement of the cost, burden, and destructiveness of belligerence, which scientific and technical progress have made inevitable. What has happened is essentially this, that the natural limitations upon warfare which have existed hitherto appear to have broken down. Hitherto there has been a certain proportion between the utmost exertion of a nation at war and the rest of its activities. The art and methods of war have had a measurable relation to the resources of the community as a whole, so that it has been possible for nations to be well armed by the standards of the time, and yet remain vigorous and healthy communities and to wage successful and even unsuccessful wars without exhaustion. To take a primitive example, it was possible for the Zulu people, under King Chaka, to carry warfare as it was understood in South Africa, a business of spear fighting on foot, to its utmost perfection, and to remain prosperous and happy themselves, whatever might be the fate inflicted upon their neighbors. And even the armies of continental Europe, as they existed before the Great War, were manifestly bearable burdens, because they were born. But the outbreak of the struggle forced upon the belligerents, in spite of the natural conservatism of all the professional soldiers, a rapid and logical utilization of the still largely neglected resources of mechanical and chemical science, they were compelled to take up every device that offered. However costly it might be, they could not resist the drive toward scientific war, which they themselves had released. In warfare, the law of the utmost immediate exertion rules. The combatant who does not put in all of his possible energy is lost. In 4 brief years, therefore, Europe was compelled to develop a warfare monstrously out of proportion to any conceivable good which the completest victory would have possibly achieved for either side. We may take as a typical instance of this logical and necessary exaggeration which warfare has undergone, the case of the tank. The idea of a land ironclad was an old and very obvious one, which had been disliked and resisted by military people for many years. The substantial basis of the European armies of 1914 was still comparatively inexpensive in infantry, assisted by machine guns and field guns and cavalry. By 1918, the infantry line is sustained by enormous batteries of guns of every caliber, firing away an incredible wealth of ammunition. Its structure includes the most complicated system of machine gun nest and strong post conceivable, and every important advance is preceded by lines of airplanes and sustained by fleets of these new and still developing weapons, the tanks. Every battle sees scores of the latter monsters put out of action. Now, even the primitive tank of 1917 cost, quite apart from the very high running expenses, something between $35,000 and $50,000. At that stage, it was still an expedient of trial and in the rough. But its obvious corollary in movable big gun forts with ammunition tenders, forts will probably be made in parts and built near the point of use, however costly they may be, is practically dictated if war is to continue. So too is a production of light and swift types of tank that will serve many of the purposes of cavalry. They will be mechanical cavalry, more effective but vastly more costly. If war is to continue as a human possibility, this elaboration of the tank in scale and species follows inevitably. A mere piece of an old type is likely to accelerate rather than check this elaboration. Only a piece that will abolish the probability of war from human affairs can release the nations from the manifest necessity of cultivating the tank, multiplying the tank, and maintaining a great manufacture and store of tanks, over and above all the other belligerent plants that they had to keep going before 1914. And these tanks will supersede nothing, unless perhaps to a certain extent, cavalry. The tank growing greater and greater and more numerous and various is manifestly, therefore, one new burden, one of many new burdens, which must rest upon the shoulders of mankind henceforth, until the prospect of war can be shut off from international affairs. It is foolish to ignore these grimly budding possibilities of the tank. There they are, and they cannot be avoided if war is to go on. But the tank is only one of quite a multitude of developments which are bound to be followed up if the modern war process continues. There is no help for it. In every distinction, there is the same story to be told of an unavoidable elaboration of the means of war beyond the scale of any conceivable war end. As a second instance, let us take the growth in size, range, and destructiveness of air war. Few people realize fully what a vast thing the air service has become. A big aeroplane of the Raider type may cost something up to $100,000. The smallest cost not much less than $5,000. The pilot and the observer are the very flower of the youth of the country. They probably cost society many thousands of dollars worth of upbringing and education, and they've made little to no productive contribution to human resources. And these costly units have been multiplied enormously. From a poor 100 or so airplanes at the outset of the war, Great Britain alone has expanded her air forces until she is an output of thousands of new machines a month. Aerodromes abound throughout the country, and there's scarcely a corner of England where the hum of the passing aeroplane is not to be heard. Now, with all this vast plant of airplane factories and instruction, aerodromes must be kept up. Once it's been started, war or no war, until war is practically impossible. It may be argued, perhaps, that during a peace spell, some portion of the material may be applied to civil air transport, but the manufacturers have made it abundantly clear that this project does not strike them as reasonable or desirable. Their industry has been created as an armament industry they wish it to remain. And besides this opposition of the interested profiteer, we have to remember that the airplane is imported into warfare, possibilities of surprise hitherto undreamed of. So long as a sudden declaration of war or attack preceding a declaration of war is possible, it is now an imperative, not only that the air force of a country should always be kept in striking condition, but that the whole vast organization of coastal and frontal anti-aircraft defenses should be equally ready. Tens of thousands of men, most of them economically very valuable, will have to keep watch day and night, prepared at any moment to flash into warfare again. The same story of a tremendous permanent expansion of war equipment could be repeated in a score of parallel instances drawn from land war and sea war. Enormous new organizations of anti-submarine flotillas, of mine material and its production, of poison gas manufacture and the like, have, for instance, been called into existence and must now remain as going concerns so long as war is likely to be renewed. But enough examples have been cited here to establish the reality of this present unrestricted, illimitable, disproportionate growth of the war process in comparison with all other human processes. Mars has become a young cuckoo in the nest of human possibilities, and it is, to state the extreme alternatives, a choice before mankind. Whether we will drift on toward catastrophe due to that overgrowth, or so organize the world as effectually to restrain and reduce warfare. It is not impossible to adumbrate the general nature of the catastrophe which threatens mankind if war-making goes on. Modern warfare is not congenial to the working masses anywhere. No doubt the primitive form of warfare, a murderous bickering with adjacent tribes, is natural enough to uneducated men. But modern warfare, and still more the preparation for it, involves distresses, strains, and a continuity of base and narrow purpose, quite beyond the patience and interest of the millions of ordinary men who find no other profit in it but suffering. The natural man is more apt for chaotic local fighting than for large-scale systematic fighting. Hatred campaigns and a sustained propaganda are needed to keep up a combatant spirit in large modern states, even during actual hostilities, and in the case of Russia we have a striking example of the distaste a whole population may develop for the war strain, even during the war and with the enemy at its gates. What is likely to happen, then, when the working masses of Central and Western Europe, no longer sustained by the immediate excitement of actual war, find themselves still obliged to go on year after year, producing vast masses of war material, pledged to carry a heavy burden of war loan rentiers on their backs, and subjected to an exacerbated conscription? Possibly so far as the rentier burden upon the worker goes, a great rise in the prices and wages will relieve the worker to some extent, but only at the cost of acute disappointment and distress at another social level. There is a dangerously narrowing limit now to the confidence of the common man and the intelligence and good faith of those who direct his affairs, and a probability of a cruel, confused class war throughout Europe, roughly parallel in its methods to the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, and released by a similar loss of faith in leaders and government, appears at the end of the vista of waste of directive energy and natural resources, completing that waste of energy and resources into which the belligerent systems of Europe, the German Empire being the chief and foremost, have led mankind. Systematic force, overstrained and exhausted, will then give place to chaotic force, and general disorganization will ensue. Thereafter, the world may welter in confusion for many generations through such ruinous and impoverished centuries as close the Roman imperial story, before it develops the vitality for an effective reorganization. That roughly is the idea of the phrase of a downfall of civilization as used in discussions like these. It is the vision of the world as a social system collapsing chaotically, not under the assault of outer barbarians, but beneath the pressure of this inevitable hypertrophy of war. 3. Let us now look a little more closely between these two extremes of possibility we have stated in the preceding section, between a world unanimity for peace, on the one hand, every man's world league of nations, and a world collapse under the overgrowth of war organization and material, on the other. First, we have to consider the possibility of some belligerent state achieving so much victory as to establish a world hegemony and a peace based on force and the relieving of pressure by an enforced and controlled world disarmament. We should then have a League of Nations project realized in very different form and spirit indeed than from the League of Every Man, but still realized as the dictated peace of a subjugated world, rather after the pattern of the Roman Empire. Such was probably the hope, and not altogether unreasonable hope, having regard to the self-confidence of the German people, the rottenness of Russia, the Irish disorders, and the unpreparedness of America, of many far-seeing Germans in the early phases of the war. But the affairs of the world are now in a posture which enables us to dismiss the idea of a world hegemony for Germany, or for any other single power, as a fantastic vanity. We have to consider, however, the much greater possibility of a group of more powerful states, including perhaps a chastened Germany, agreeing amongst themselves to organize and enforce peace in a world forever. This would give us a third type of a league, which we may call a league for the senior states. It is perhaps the most probable of all the intermediate possibilities. And on the other hand, we have assumed quite crudely in the first section that the forces of popular insurrection are altogether destructive of organization, whereas they may yet be unmeasured constructive and organizing power in the popular mind. There is a middle way between a superstitious belief in unguided democracy and a frantic hatred of it. Concurrently, for example, with the earlier phases of Bolshevik anarchy in Petrograd and Moscow, there seems to have been for a time a considerable development of a cooperative production and distribution throughout Europe and Asiatic Russia. Mingled with merely destructive and vindictive insurrectionism, there may be a popular will to order, reaching out to cooperate with all the sound and liberal forces of the old system of things. We can only guess as yet the probabilities of a collective will in these peasant and labor masses of Europe, which now read and write, and have newborn ideas of class action and responsibility. They will be ill-informed, and they may be emotional, but they may have vast reserves of common sense. Much may depend upon the unforeseeable accident of great leaders. Nearly every socialist and democratic organization in the world, it is to be noted, now demands the League of Nations in some form, and men may arise who will be able to give that still quite vague demand force and creative definition. A failure to achieve a world guarantee of peace on the part of diplomatists at a peace conference may lead, indeed, to a type of insurrection and revolution not merely destructive but preparatory. It is conceivable. The deliberate organization of peace, as distinguished from a mere silly clamor for peace, may break out at almost any social level and in the form of either a constructive, an adaptive, or revolutionary project. We have not, therefore, here a case of clear-cut choice of two ways. There is a multitude of roads which may converge on the permanent organizations of world peace, and an infinitude of thwarting and delaying digressions may occur. Complicating and mitigatory circumstances may, and probably will, make this antagonism of war and peace a lengthy and torturous drama. The collapse of Russia tempted Germany to outrageous aggressions upon her eastern frontier, and so brought out the opposition of the militarist and pacifist conception of life, with the acutest, most illuminating simplicity. But other such collapses may not have this effect of simplifying and enforcing the issue. They may merely encourage powers adjacent to the region of collapse to adopt a partial disarmament, a mere resting phase, so as to defer scores of years by this temporary mitigation, the necessity for securely ending war. There may be many such halts and setbacks in the inevitable development of war. Belligerents may pause and take breath of several occasions before its ultimate death flurry. Such delays, such backwater phases and secondary aspects must not confuse the issue or hide from us the essential fact of the disappearance of any real limitation upon the overgrowth of war in human life. That unlimited overgrowth is the probability which is driving more and more men to study of the advocacy of the project of the League of Nations, because they are convinced that only through a counter-organization of the peace will in mankind can the world be saved from a great cycle of disasters, disorder, and retrogression. And it does not follow, because the origins and motives of the will for such a world league are various, that they involve a conflict over essentials as to the character of the final result. It is the declared belief of many of the promoters of the World League movement that a careful analysis of the main factors of its problems, a scientific examination of what is possible, what is impossible, what is necessary, and what is dangerous, must lead the mass of reasonable men in the world, whatever their class, origins, traditions, and prejudices, to a practical agreement upon the main lines of the scheme for the salvation of mankind. It is to believe that the clear, deliberate, and methodical working out of the broad problems and riddles of the World League idea will have a sufficient compelling force to bring it within the realm of practical possibility. This concludes the first half of The Idea of a League of Nations by H.G. Wells and the Rhodes-Milner Roundtable Group. If you'd like to download the full audiobook, please visit patreon.com/KevinColeUOP or unityofthepolis.com. Thanks for listening.